This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas, powered by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, I'm Philip C and welcome to The Breakfast Grill. On today's Breakfast Grill, I'm in conversation with Lawrence Chia, CEO of the Samling Group of Companies, one of Malaysia's largest integrated timber companies. A very good morning to you, Lawrence. How are you keeping?
Morning. Fine.
Now, you're one of the largest end-to-end timber companies in Malaysia. What have been the biggest shifts and changes in the timber industry in the past decade?
I think you have to say is that we're all moving towards a much more greener space. And obviously, when we talk about that, we talk about the ESG, we talk about sustainability in terms of that sort of business. And I think that this is certainly the biggest change. Change in what? In attitude, behavior of the business, of the whole ecosystem, from buyers to producers to the financiers. I think that the whole ecosystem is moving towards the same, you know, awareness that they need to do something for that.
Right. So the big delta is sustainability. You're seeing that change across the whole ecosystem. So just looking at your land, 1.2 million hectares of forest land, 190,250 hectares of gross plantable forest plantations. Yeah. What kind of behavior of changes have taken place in how you manage the forest and land now versus, say, 10 years ago?
This is certainly in line with what the government's been doing. I think that this sort of change is obviously the government is fully in line with that, in the sense that it's all driven by government. I think maybe 25 years ago or 30 years ago, government of Sarawak actually realized that the fact that, you know, we got to move into, they probably don't use the word sustainability, but they're certainly, you know, moving into the areas of preservation and protection of their forests, being the biggest resource. And how do you do that? And the fact that they still need an industry, timber today in Sarawak still contributing significant part of the GDP.
It's a significant part of the economy. So I always wonder, how do you find the right balance, you know, besides needing to preserve versus needing to generate economic value and output?
Good question. I think that the fact that we're not inventing the wheel per se. I think many countries in the world today, you think New Zealand, you know, probably people don't realize 90% of New Zealand today are really plantation forests. The natural forest is all gone, basically, in a sense. And today, I think in New Zealand, 30% of the GDP is from forestry.
Yeah, so bring it closer to Sarawak then. Yeah. What's our replanting strategy then here in Sarawak?
Basically, so how do we move from the natural forest to a position whereby we still have a sustainable and important drivers of the economy, which is the timber business, right? So we have to move towards plantation business. So the Sarawak government 25 years ago actually outlined that and said that look, we have to continue to build on this thing, but it's a different landscape. We've got to go into plantation business. So they have allocated up to 1 million hectares of land in Sarawak. If you want to have a sustainable business in the future, you have to go into plantation. That's what they say. You have to go in, you have to plant, you got to do silviculture, and then from there you harvest the plant and you continue planting again. So it became more like a circular type thing. You know, you plant the trees, you harvest the tree, you use the tree, and then you plant again. You understand what I'm saying? By doing that, you actually protect. There's no necessity for you to go to lock the natural forest.
What's the percentage then of your current timber that's replanted?
Today, I would say that 60-70%, but we're moving to by 2025, I think we'll be almost 100%.
So the goal is 100% by 2025. You're now at about 60-70%.
It doesn't mean that we don't have the natural forest. We still have that, the things that, but I think that we are, as a company, are moving towards generating businesses through plantation business, timber business. Yeah.
Give me the cost differential, right, between managing a plantation versus natural forest. Like, how big is the cost differential?
Huge.
How big is huge?
Natural forest grow by itself.
Yes.
It doesn't cost me anything to grow. It's there, right? Plantation forest, you got to do clearing, you got to do planting.
Absolutely.
You do nursery, you do all the things that goes with that.
It is painful. It comes with a cost, but it's necessary for the regeneration of the forest, for that sustainability element, isn't it? I guess then the question is, with the incremental cost, how do you manage the cost then?
Well, we have the fact that I think that environment is generating that. I think that, like I say, you know, the whole world is moving towards the angle. The idea of sustainability and all these things today, we talk about climate change effects and things like that. It didn't start yesterday. They've been talking about this thing for the last 30, 40 years. It's just that this is something that felt that the cost-benefit equation thing, you know, the thing is that if you do that, is the price of your product from plantation forest going to be justified? That obviously, in the past, it doesn't. But having said that now, in the last few years, you can see the moving towards from the buyer's perspective, they're saying, you know, we want that. We want that sort of product from plantation.
So the demand is coming through. They're willing to to pay. So you can pass through that incremental cost to the customer.
We hope so. You know, you can't survive. And I mean, there's a lot.
You have to. You have no choice, isn't it?
Basically, no choice.
Yeah.
So that's all part of the evolving and constant evaluation of our business in terms of, you know, people say the timber business, we have been timber business for 50 years. But it's the fact that it's a plantation, it's a totally new ball game, isn't it?
Yeah.
New customers, new methodology, new harvesting techniques, and new investment path and things like that. So it's a totally new, the guy that buying your products from natural forests is a different guy. I mean, the guy, you'd say, I don't like plantation forests. On the other hand, we got new customer coming in and say, we only want plantation.
Is that why your customer segment is changing? I mean, if you talk about who are your core customers now, Japan is one of your largest customers. Right. They probably are the ones with the most exacting demands. They want to make sure that they are certified well. What kind of certifications are required for these global customers to take Samling Timber?
So they are internationally recognized certification of forests that the Malaysian, we call it the MTCC, with the Malaysian Certification Body, are aligned to. So we have to, you know, go with one of these certifications. So all our forests is our aim, that certainly all our forests will in some shape or form certify by 2025. So that's our aim towards that.
What's the percentage now that's certified?
Today we are about 70%, 78%. Yeah, exactly, I don't quite know yet. But
So the pathway
the
is...
The pandemic didn't help.
Well, the pandemic presumably slowed down the whole process of certification.
Well, it's not only
Did
that.
It delayed
the
by
thing
2 years?
That you have to plan. You see, it's okay to say that, you know, we all forests need to be certified. But there's an economic angle to that. You know, you've got to have a critical land bank of planted trees. Mm. If not, how do you have a business? You understand? So the fact that, you know, the pandemic restriction of movement of laborers and things like that, we just couldn't get people to go and do the planting. And with this, with the COVID-19 thing, you know what I mean.
I can imagine it's super hard to basically take that plantation approach. And I think what you're saying
delayed.
It delayed it. The pandemic made it even harder for you to achieve that goal,
correct,
right, of 2025, 100%. It will be easy to just go towards a natural rainforest, isn't it, to pursue that pathway, to keep that growth trajectory. But I just want to come back to the numbers again, right? You say that, you know, it all comes at a cost, this plantation business, this transition to plantation. What is the incremental cost we're talking about? Just give me a delta.
Oh, significant. I think that, I can tell you that the plantation costing us, we go by tonnage, yeah, right? You know, costing us ringgit probably $300 per ton, you know, and that is the cost of it in terms of roughly. So the question becomes, from the tree, you become a manufactured product, whether you can recover the cost or not, plus all the other production costs that goes with it, right? So basically, that's what it is.
Is that why the strategy was to move further downstream? Because, you know, in the past 10 years, there's been a lot of work by Samling, not to just only come out with just logs only and timber, but to also move into fabrication, kitchen cabinets and such, right? You move downstream to actually even go to the retail side. Is that the strategy that still holds or not?
It is a strategy, but having said that, it's a strategy encouraged by the government. Because in our business in Sarawak today, forest is a big resource. But you got to go into processing. Processing creates jobs, different opportunities for the people of Sarawak. Whereas if you just do natural timber, you log in the cell, there's no processing.
But the question is not whether the government wants, but whether you have economic incentive, whether you feel there's an economic incentive to go into fiberboards, flooring, furniture, right? Door facing, door production. Does it deliver better margin for you versus exporting timber and locks?
Yes, I think it does.
How much more margins does it deliver incrementally?
Well, every process that you value add, there is a profit element. You know,
sure,
you wouldn't do it at the end of the day, right? So it's like accumulation of that. In our world, we're saying that the more integrated you are, you should be able to save costs and also add on the profit. Fundamentally, that's what it is.
So break down for me the revenue stream of Samling at the moment. How much of it is upstream versus downstream from a top line and bottom line standpoint?
Take last year.
Yeah.
Majority is downstream now. I would say 80% is downstream now.
And how much of that, is that top line or the bottom line? Yeah. Top line, how does it translate for the bottom line? Is it higher or lower?
In pandemic, it's a bit difficult because the cost is much higher because, you know, last year, our volume has gone down. There's no question about it. Not because there's no forest or anything, because our production capability has been significantly affected, right? So if you look at it in terms of production relating to revenue, we actually have higher margins because the price has gone up.
Yes.
But if you look at in totality, it has gone down. You understand what I'm saying?
I know what you mean. From a percentage-wise, you're seeing that improvement,
yes,
but it absolutely didn't come through.
Yes.
Because what I think you're saying is that, look, you just cannot produce enough timber to move downstream. Although, to be fair, during the pandemic, we were all flushed with high demand for office furniture, for home-based furniture, yeah, will we not? Exactly. There was so much demand for that.
You know, the reports came up, furniture has gone up by 10% in Malaysia. You know, we've gone up to $19 billion. Right? So everything has moved up. But it doesn't mean, if you analyze it, I'm not too sure the volume has gone up. You understand? The price has gone up. So margin has gone up. The one that we're in, we're into biomass, right? In the biomass today, 6 months ago, it was only like $90 per ton, right? Yesterday, I had a meeting with one of the buyers from Europe. They are talking about $350 now. You see the movement. Of course, a lot of that because of the war and things like that. But nevertheless, there is a big push on commodity in terms of all this thing.
And that's, I think, very interesting because the whole push to biomass, because you have also started building these mills for wood pellets, which is part of the energy source, right? When you calculate and do the portfolio, in view that there's so much volatility in the price of biomass now, do you think that it is too risky to punt your money in that where it's still volatile? Or do you think it's a natural progression that eventually you're going to produce more timber for energy as opposed for furniture?
Well, the decision was made wasn't because of that. Mm. Although the end result looks it that way. So when we started off this strategy and say that we want to move into plantation business, and the fact that, just like I mentioned to you, that in the plantation business, the cost is far higher because you got to do the planting and whatnot and nurturing or things like that, the cost is much higher. Therefore, it's just like anything, right? So how do you recover the cost? So to recover the cost means you got to be able to use 100% of the forest that you plant. Unlike that, the natural forest, you know, you do selective logging, you know, things you don't like, you don't do it because the cost is not so much there. You know, it didn't cost you anything to let the forest grow, right? So we have to be more savvy, more efficient in the way we drive our business. The biomass part of the business is that in a forest, obviously, for your forest that you plant, you want to have higher value items. The higher value item comes from the downstream, like I say, added processes and things like that, right? But not every piece of the forest, the tree, can be used for that. There will be some part of the forest that you cannot use, right? So then we start thinking, what is the part that I can use more? And also the fact that it was climate change issues and whatnot. And we were just lucky, I suppose. We were approached by, you know, one of the Japanese buyers and talking to us, you know, have you guys thought about doing this thing? Then I said, oh, great, that fits into exactly what I want. Mm. So now I can use 100% of the forest. You see where I'm getting at? So the biomass is like everything else. the other parts of downstream don't use. I just bring it over and just do the biomass now. So effectively, we are using 100% of the forest now.
On The Breakfast Grill, I'm in conversation with Lawrence Chia, CEO of Sumling Group of Companies. After the break, diversification beyond logging. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Welcome back. On The Breakfast Grill, I'm in conversation with Lawrence Chia, CEO of the Sumling Group of Companies, as we unpack the challenges in navigating a business environment where ESG credentials are in the spotlight. Lawrence, we talked about your experience leading before Sumling. You came from Deloitte. You actually ran, I think, many Deloitte businesses. How big was that shift coming from Deloitte to running kind of a business entrepreneurial setup like Sumling Group of Companies?
You know, I think we all started off in Deloitte as an auditor, you know, learning about financials and whatnot, analyzing figures and things like that. But I think towards the later part of my career in Deloitte, I was moving into what we call the advisory space, basically advising companies and corporates and about their business and how do you improve your business, how do you leverage it, and that sort of stuff. So I think in that sense, I'm quite familiar with that because that was more of an advisor. And something in the sense that I know the family quite well, and you know, before I joined them, we know each other more than 10 years, and so I do understand a bit of some of their business dealings and not. When I joined, obviously, one is a professional advisory capacity. Now you come in here and
drive change.
Huge change, right? Yeah. Change, but challenging, huge change, but very interesting in the sense that, you know, when you're on a professional background, you advise and that's it. Whether your client take your advice or not, you move on, right? Yeah. I suppose that here is different. And when you look at it and you decide that you want to do it, you got to come up with your plans, your feasibility, and your investment money into it. And then you got to get your return on capital and things like that. So you actually put your words into action here and see the fruition of that and the impact it makes to the company, both in terms of employees, the markets, and technology as well. So I think it's challenging. And that's where the big cultural shift as well into doing things for something.
I guess you were recruited to also imbue the cultural shift because as many as you probably know, Sumling has been under a lot of spotlight and scrutiny, right, over its ESG credentials. You've seen the reports. Even if you look at your media releases in the past 2 years, I think of the 15, 20, only three or four are all proactive. Everything is in defense of either a foreign or local NGO or media report, I think, kind of lambasting you for all your perceived illegal activities and such, in which you have vigorously defended, right? How distracting are all these allegations against Samling Group companies?
No, this is obviously very distracting. I'd rather put my focus on the people, the business, and making things work, having big impact in the livelihood of the people in Samling. I mean, today we have 15,000 employees. I mean, it's not a small organization, So, we need to improve the standard of living, the way all this thing, all the people there in Samling. So I'd rather focus on that sort of thing. I'd rather be distracted of some of this thing.
I know, but there's so many concerns, right, about the lack of engagement, about the fact that you're going through illegal land, illegal logging. And how do you manage all these issues that come through? Because the press releases, there's always a template response, which is, it is up to the Malaysian Timber Certification Council. It's the contingent on the Sarawak government. Are we passing the buck over to the Sarawak government for all these issues then?
Well, not really. I mean, what we're saying is that we have to be probably more transparent of things we do. We are a private... So I bring in here in the sense that we need to be more transparent, telling people exactly what we do. There's nothing to hide from us. We are a law-abiding corporate, a significant player in that sector, that industry. We are responsible to the government, both in Sarawak as well, the federal government, in championing it and developing, continue to develop the timber sector business for the country and for the state. So I think we need to be more transparent. So a lot of these issues, the allegations you have, I think a lot of these things basically, they do not understand fully the legal process and the processes that we undertake, which is all prescribed by the government and by the state. So we're not pushing it. We're just saying that everything we do is in line with all the regulation policies of the government, right?
In line. So the question really is, what stops you from being transparent now?
We have been transparent now. So the fact that we are doing a lot of, but we can be more transparent, no doubt about that. So the move now is the fact that we embark on this sustainability journey. We engage consultants to help us to start this about 3 years ago, pre-pandemic, and then we are now moving to that. That's why you've seen the spot scores recently that we have achieved a lot in terms of disclosure and transparency and other things that we do. That's why we get a 58%.
Yeah, I saw the score that came out, I think, just a week ago. Yeah. But still, people are not happy. There are clearly indigenous communities who are very vehemently opposed to all the logging concessions awarded to you. You're seeing people from Europe putting a lot of pressure to you, to the point where I think you've also put your back into the corner. You've even filed defamation lawsuits against the likes of Save a River. So where does it all end? How do we break this cycle of animosity between yourself and many of these groups that feel that where they are living is being impacted negatively?
Well, all I can say is that we have been very transparent. We do work with the communities. Livelihood of the communities and the natives that are important to us. And a lot of people doesn't know, 86% of our employees, 86% of our employees are the natives. So their livelihood is important to us. So a lot of things, the allegation, they're made, obviously, today, I don't want to comment too much about it. Why? Because there's, like you say, there's a court case.
Yeah.
But it's not taken lightly, or flippantly. We are very serious, very committed. If you look at what we are, the last thing we want to do is to take legal suit against anybody. So what I'm trying to say is that all the things they say is not true. But we are not in the modus operandi for us to go and sue everything the same. It's not the way we want to do things.
It is so distracting for the business.
It is distracting. There's no question about that.
Because at the beginning when we talked about where your customers are demanding for this quality and certification,
correct,
right? And you've said actually in your press releases that it has affected business to a certain point, right?
Yeah,
how bad
has
it been in terms of affecting business, all these lawsuits and all these allegations then?
Well, I don't think loss is affecting the business. But I certainly, some of this allegation is a distraction in the sense that external stakeholders obviously wants to know. If those allegations are true, then frankly speaking, we shouldn't be in business. Simple as that, right? But we are saying, we have to explain to them, show them evidence and things like that, that this is not what we are doing. Very simply, right? Like I said, everything we do, especially when it comes to land, when we come to resources, everything requires government license, government permits and things like that, right? We wouldn't be doing anything. Look, we have been in business for 50 years. If we are really doing some of the things they say, why would we have a license to do things?
So moving forward, what are the 2-3 tangible next steps to improve transparency? Because you said that more needs to be done on the transparency front. Fine, you've basically got yourself certified globally, right? You've been part of the spot ranking. What are the other 2-3 more tangible actions actions that you're committed to do to improve transparency so that we don't have all these allegations flying around and can be refuted relatively fast so that you can remain focused on the business?
Well, allegation, I think, will never stop. I think that, you know, that's part of the business we have. But all we are saying now is that everything we do will be disclosed 100% as much as we can, right? Within the limits of what we can do. In the past, maybe being a private company, we don't. You know, things like environmental studies and nature studies and all the things that goes with it. But now we've undertaken that we will disclose as much as possible. In fact, we do disclose. There's some. There's just that, you know, the natives, they don't look at it as or made aware as much as it is, right? So we can improve in that. Certainly, I think more dialogue with them is also important. I think it's in our steps that going forward that we must have more dialogue with the community in terms of all the things that we are doing, sharing with them what we're doing, things like.
And this disclosure is very important as we move forward and talk about access to capital. Yeah, because in the beginning when we talked about, you know, Samling's journey towards more sustainability, access to capital is going to be very key to try and expand and diversify your business, move into wood timber, biomass and such. So jog my memory in terms of your exit from the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, right, when you delisted about 10 years ago. What was the motivation then?
Well, I think the motivation then is basically, I think that we could use our talent much better. When I say talent, really more the senior executives' talent. Yeah. So when you are a public company, is a lot of things, you know, you say disclosure, but having said that, a lot of things also not share with the other groups.
But that's the argument, isn't it? That, you know, we talk about the need for transparency, but, the point about the delisting was that it was in frustration that there was so much disclosure required. That's a bit of a contradiction, no?
No, it wasn't so much a disclosure. I think it's not so much that. It's more so that I think the more efficient use of the talent that we have, you know, that we don't, for us to use that talent, that person got to resign from that group and join this group, that sort of thing like that. So I think one is driven by the better use of talent. The group is getting bigger and bigger, more and more diversified. I mean, we just need much more of this expert to share around and make full use. That's the main driver there. Secondly, obviously, also, you know, you mentioned about access to capital. I think a better utilization of the capital that we have, we can employ our capital better, more efficient, right? I mean, because we operate in so many countries, the fact that I think that you agree with me that having a vast treasury function for the whole group is much better than trying to operate all separately and things like that, you see? So I think it's driven by that. It's driven by the use of talent. I think that overall, try to make the group much, much better. And the other thing also, the last thing I want to comment is that people don't really understand the group in a sense. That why? Because if you look at that time, the share price was trading very low. And I remember having this conversation, you know, with the shareholders and say that they were asking them, why is the share price so low? You know, basically that, are you making money? Yes, we're making money. So you know, why are you, do you want to sell? No. So then, why you worry about that? Now, well, this is where
that is communication, though.
No, not so much that. You see, I didn't understand what was driving them to say, oh, hang on a minute. Why we're concerned is that the banks are saying that the market capitalization of the group, they look at that. You know, the bank, whatever it is, they use that as a KPI and say, look here, the share price are going down. Therefore, you got to have a better market cap. You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So and all that is also part of it. I'm not saying that's the main thing. You know, people don't understand the group as a whole. So they were trading in such a way that, you know, share price is so low that it must be a private company.
As you move forward now, you have these plans to expand and diversify the business downstream biomass. How easy is it to access capital? You know, you've had that kind of reputation tarnished. There was this whole talk about the Norwegian pension fund also exiting, reducing its stake in Samling, you know, a couple of years back. That must be etched in some people's minds as well, right? How easy is it for the group to access capital markets
this
now?
This is when they were public, right?
Yes, that's right. That's history that's still scarring, no?
I don't think so. I mean, so far, I mean, since I've been the CEO, I don't think it's always been brought up anything in that sense, right? But no, I don't think it's affected in terms of our relationship with the bankers and the financial institution. Whatever. In fact, if anything, they understand our group much better now. You know, through obviously disclosure and things like that, and the fact that we're now operating as a group, that therefore they can see what assets we have and things. In the past, they can't, you see. So I think it's more about disclosure in that sense, right? The key stakeholders are getting much more better understanding of the whole group and how we operate and things like that.
One of the things that when you came in, I think you had to do was, I think perhaps restructure and also simplify the business. Because, you know, Samling, I think a couple of years back, had their fingers in many, many things, I believe, in palm oil. I think they still do have in palm oil. But you also had automotive distribution business. Am I right to say that you're out of it, exited from that already?
I still have the automotive business.
Okay. How big is that contribution to the business generally? Because there was a lot of talk about IPOing it about 3-4 years ago. Has that IPO plan been shelved then?
It's certainly been revisited. I think that the move, you know, it's always doing going to electric cars and things like that. So we have to look at all this business going forward in terms of what it is. Investment got to be made and things like that. So I think, I wouldn't say that, you know, we dropped the plans for IPO and things like that. It's been probably revisited.
Being reassessed. So you're still selling Bentleys. You're still selling Hondas and Mitsubishi. So still delivering for the business. You've not exited the business. In fact, you might be doubling down and actually moving into EVs then.
We are moving into EVs. That's a fact. I mean, the, you know, regulations are coming in Malaysia as well. And in Singapore is already coming in terms of X percentage of cars going to be EVs, right? So yeah, the whole business model's been slightly changed. And we got to relook at that and things like that.
And I'm sure I'm just touching the iceberg because I'm sure the Samling Group has so many of all these very disparate and distinct portfolio companies. How do you organize and manage all these different portfolios where there's very little synergy between them then?
Now that we do have sort of like CEOs and the groups, all of them have it, and they sort of run it on a standalone business as it is. We basically use talent in that sense. It's the CEOs, their team, and run their business as like a standalone type thing.
Lawrence, thank you for spending your time with us. On The Breakfast Grill, Lawrence Chia, CEO of the Samling Group of Companies, not only a timber company, but a conglomerate intending it to future-proof its business in a sustainable manner. I'm Philip C, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, where unlimited potential begins.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.